UCR Podcast.
Happy holidays, everybody. I know it's a crazy week, and maybe you're about to start the drive to wherever you have to go. Maybe you're going to get on a plane, wherever you might be headed. Take the new Counting Crows documentary with you if you're looking for a good holiday watch. Counting Crows, they are one of those bands that have taken their share of abuse, both from fans and critics, during the more than three decades that they've been making music together. And whatever the source and focus of that might be, I do think it's unfair, and those people are missing out on a group that continues to record really important songs and albums. Witness Virginia Through the Rain from their latest record, Butter Miracle, The Complete Suites, which came out earlier this year. As director Amy Scott shared with me in the conversation you're going to hear today, the story of Counting Crows, the band, is one that is still being written as frontman, songwriter, and leader Adam Duritz continues to add chapters through his work, putting down the words to these incredible songs. With that in mind, she decided to focus her film on the origin story of the San Francisco group, and specifically the first two albums, 1993's August and Everything After, and its follow-up, Recovering the Satellites, which came out in 1996. Amy's film is called Counting Crows, Have You Seen Me Lately? And you can watch it right now on HBO Max. It's one that I've been looking forward to for a long time now. I had the privilege of speaking to archivist Jackie Clary. You're going to hear me mention her again, but she's somebody I've known for a number of years now, and I was really excited when she told me that she was part of a team working on a film about Counting Crows. And Amy has a great description of Jackie's work on this movie that I won't spoil, but in a nutshell, when you're watching a documentary and you see that amazing rare footage that maybe you've never seen, or you've certainly never seen it in that quality, Jackie is one of those people in the music and movie business that works to research and track that stuff down. So we had a conversation where she wanted to pick my brain a bit as a fellow Counting Crows nerd, and she told me why she wanted to have that conversation, and I've been waiting every day since then for the chance to finally see this film, and I'm happy to report that it was more than worth the wait. Amy, Jackie, and the rest of the team did an incredible job pulling together what we are seeing visually in Have You Seen Me Lately, and we get some really interesting insights from Adam and the band, and there were a few stories I hadn't heard with the level of detail that you get in this film. And as I expressed to Amy, it feels like both August and Everything After and Recovering the Satellites are a bit underrated when it comes to the records that people hold up these days as being on that list of the 1,000 albums you have to hear before you die and so on. So I hope that for the folks who have not gone beyond the singles with Counting Crows, that perhaps they will give those albums and this band a further look. If you like what you see here from Amy Scott, check out the previous films that she's done. She mentions the film that she worked on about Hal Ashby. She was also behind the cameras for Sheryl Crow's 2022 documentary and, separately, an extremely compelling docuseries on Melissa Etheridge called I'm Not Broken that you can see on Paramount Plus. And you can keep up with everything that Amy has done and everything she's got coming up at amyelizabethscott.com. As a bonus on today's episode, I'm going to put in the conversation that I had with Adam Duritz earlier this year on the podcast, where we dug through a number of topics, including his love of bootleg collecting, paying tribute to Van Morrison at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony in 1993, and the period when they were working on Recovering the Satellites, and the interesting way that they introduced the album to the world, and lots more, including discussion of their newest music. It is Matt Wardlaw. If this is your first time listening to the UCR podcast, follow us so that you will get the new episodes as they are released. And of course, whatever we're talking about here, you're going to find a lot more at ultimateclassicrock.com, where we take pride in flying our music nerd flag 200% of the time. And if you dig what you're hearing here on the podcast, please rate and review wherever you might be listening. We appreciate it a lot. Here is our conversation with Amy Scott about her latest film, Counting Crows, Have You Seen Me Lately? Enjoy. Thank you, Amy. Thanks for taking some time here.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I love the film, so thank you for
making it. That's my first question. Have you seen it?
I was going to say, I've seen it lately. Yeah, I was going to make that bad dad joke, but yeah, we'll skip it. Here's where I want to start. Let's just start with folks that maybe are not aware of this film. What is your origin story with this band? Like, how did they land on your radar originally? And what do you think it was in the long run that grabbed you?
Well, I'm from Oklahoma. I was in high school in the 90s. So I think August and Everything After maybe came out my junior or senior year of high school. So it was everywhere. And I followed the band, but not in a super fan way. I think I was edging more at that point, definitely into classic rock, and then far alternative rock also. But I was always aware of him. I thought Adam was an interesting. I thought he predated emo in a way. I thought, oh, he's an interesting guy that's singing about his feelings, and putting it on top 40 radio. Decades later, I just really was interested in working with Bill Simmons and The Ringer, and the Music Box series does such a great job because the Counting Crows story's not over yet. It's not something where you can go, well, this is it, and it ended here, and then you could tell that arc of the story. I also find those films really challenging to make and to watch. So if there was a moment, sort of a crucible moment for the band, it was those first two records, I thought. And Bill Simmons had done an interview with Adam that he asked me to listen to see if I also thought, as he thought, that there would be a pretty remarkable film with Adam, just based on his intelligence and his way of storytelling, which obviously was right on the money. So I was very lucky in my entry point in with this whole project.
Yeah, I think you know from having made a number of films on your side of things, that's one thing that whether it's a film or a long form story or whatever it is, however you're telling the story, you hope that you're going to have a reliable narrator. And that is something that seems like I've
Dude.
talked to Adam a number of times, and it seems like you certainly got that with Adam in the case of this film.
Yes, and that is the most you have to have a reliable narrator. They don't have to necessarily be likable the whole time. In fact, it's more engaging if they're not, in that way. Like everything's great and we had a great run. It's like that's not a story. But if you have a compelling hero, the hero's journey is full of landmines and things and struggles that that person has to overcome, but they do it with humility and, in Adam's case, intelligence and humor is what I really responded to.
I like that the first thing that we see with this film as we start watching it is we see you, and you lay out the basic intent by saying,
Oh my God.
despite over 30 years of success, Counting Crows remains one of the most polarizing bands in rock history. In this film, I focused on the first two Counting Crows records. I wanted to trace the roots of what inspired so much adoration as well as so much vitriol. And that is such an interesting, like, that's a great thing to hang a film on because it is kind of a fascinating story. I kind of wondered, like, where did the seeds of that start taking root with you? Because I know that's something certainly early on as a fan, I saw that, and it's been fascinating to watch that over the years and how it's evolved, and really how Adam and the band have continued to defy the odds of all the odds that have been stacked against them by all the critical knocks and stuff that they took along the way. It's like they persevered, and that's another part of all this.
I just had, I remembered that sort of being the, at least in the circles I ran in college and whatnot, that was like, oh, they're cool, they're uncool, they're cool, they're uncool, which is it? And then, because music could really define in the 90s especially, it was like a really diabolical time for a musical identity. But it was a current, it was like, well, that's in there somewhere. I do want to explore that. But I think the first few interviews, like when I sat down with Adam and started talking to him about it, it was like he wanted to bring it up and he wanted to talk about, those stories of like a car rolling up next to them and saying, you screaming like Counting Crows suck, That's just, that's wild. And I wanted to kind of explore that a little bit more in terms of how, which is why we had guys like Steve Kerr in the film. Aside from the fact that Adam and Steve are really tight, it was like it would be nice to have perspectives to kind of zoom out and look at how we treat each other, how we treat artists, how fan culture can lob disrespect or respect, and what that does to a person's psyche. So it was just an interesting, part of the quilt of this, what makes that band and their story.
It's kind of interesting that when he's really struggling in San Francisco, he takes refuge in Los Angeles. That's always been kind of a pretty fascinating
Funny.
element of the story to me. Like, you would
Yeah.
never expect that if you're going to run away and find refuge somewhere, that it'd be LA. So, but that was what it was for him. So that's always been interesting to me.
I thought it was a really funny story too. I can't imagine what it would be like to look out my window and see people camping on my lawn, watching my every move, especially a person that's introverted in that way, like Adam would probably send me into the lower bar of a, the Viper room. I don't know. It was just if, as far as storytelling goes, that whole section of the film too, because it was pre-internet and we had all these other people that were so interesting, like Shannon McManus, the Viper Room manager, and Randall Slavin and Pantera Sarah, they could all sort of back it up with actual photographs. Was just like, for me, it was like, it's candy for a film. So yeah, it was a really fun thing. As a filmmaker, that was a really fun thing to explore.
I was going to ask that. How did some of those folks like Pantera Sarah come into the mix? Because those are always the characters that really give you good color. So
Good
how
color.
did just her as an example, how did somebody like her come into the mix?
I mean, Adam, he is was a really gracious with opening up his, and there was a to that extent, there was like a whole lot of people. We just ran out of time and money.
Yeah.
Oh, he's got so many. So his people, the people in his world are really fascinating folks. And he, on the subject, we would take these, lift up these different subjects and be like, for example, okay, Viper rooms, like who is in there? Who should I talk to? And as a filmmaker, I'm like, who documented it? And so he was like, hold on, let me get her number here. Call Sarah, call Shannon, Randall. I'd met Randall, of course. So it, that, that was like due diligence as a filmmaker, but mostly because Adam was really open in giving us, letting us into his world and his friend network.
Sometimes you do something like this, and either you don't have the reliable narrator, as we talked about, or you don't really have access to a lot of materials. And that was something that, even before I saw this film, I imagine you didn't have that issue. And certainly, as we watch the film, we see just the diaries, the tour journals of David Bryson's. They seem to have a pretty substantial band archive. I'm sure that Adam's own archive is a whole other rabbit hole. Like, he's done all this stuff. He did a podcast with James Campion where they talked a lot about the band and a lot about. So you really could get lost down several different rabbit holes. How did you kind of avoid doing that? It's just such an interesting thing because you have access to so much material before you even go outside of the band circle, and you could get lost, and this film could never come out. But as we know, that's why films have deadlines and stuff like that. So there are things to pull you back and ultimately establish a finish line. But it seems like it would have been interesting not working to not get lost in certain aspects of this timeline.
This is the part in the interview where I want to like give major props to my editor and my archival producer, and story producer and producers, because there are filmmakers that do it all themselves. I don't know how they do it. Oh, but Brett Morgan does it, and he makes astonishing films, and then he has had many near death, put himself in the hospital from the stress of it all. So I'm not in a position where I feel like carrying the entire load, nor do I think that I would do the best job. So I have a team of people that check me on that stuff. And my editor's brilliant with archival, going, this is the thread we need to pull on. This is going to send us down a quicksand route. We'll never come out in terms of story structure. And then our archivist, I mean, she's like a bloodhound. I mean, she's like, I'm going to give you all this stuff I found, which is her job, is to go and be a detective. So when you stumble on something though, where you have the one of the original band members that says, "Oh yeah, I did keep a tour diary. Maybe you should check that out," and then we're thinking like, "We'll see, how good could it be?" And we get it, and it's like the prototype of what all scrapbooks look like. I mean, down to like ticket stubs and just it was so detailed and so amazing and so 90s, the way that you cut stuff out in the 90s, a collage was like, zine kind of design and stuff. It blew my mind. I couldn't believe it. Like, what a gold, you just handed a big gold brick, like it
Yeah.
was so very, very, very lucky.
What were perhaps some of the more difficult dots to connect and fill in, either timeline perspective or informationally, just as you were telling the story?
Yeah, I think maybe not difficult, but just the thing that you really, really, really didn't want to fumble was handling mental health because, when someone is being extremely vulnerable and trusting with their story, making sure that you do present that in a way that's accurate to their experience and not reductive. By design, it's going to be reductive because you're taking this whole long chunk of their life and squashing it down. So, it's storytelling in a way, but you just have to be very careful to not try to exploit anybody's experience. So that was kind of the main thing that I was carrying ultimately. And then, and I know that Adam wa would wanted more music in it. I mean, just to let performances play out to be a little bit longer. There's financial restrictions on that stuff, unfortunately. But we tried the best we could. He had watched the Led Zeppelin documentary, which is phenomenal, the new Led Zeppelin. I'm
Oh,
sure.
yeah.
I mean, give me a break. Like, I watched that and I was like, oh no, I can't believe he's watched this. Like, I'm sunk, because I don't have that kind of footage. And then, if you watch that movie, I don't know if there's any silence. It's like a song's just set, full songs. Zeppelin just seg right into the next. I kept thinking I need to go to the bathroom, and I'm like, but I can't because they keep going into my next favorite song. How you use the music and when you use it and how long you use it and where you use it, that's all very challenging, because the music also tells the story too.
Yeah.
So.
What we were talking about, like the Viper Room and stuff like that, there's also the fan perspective. And I love that you mix almost like the expert of somebody being in the business with the fan in the case of talking to a worldwide superstar like Chris Martin of Coldplay. And here's Chris Martin of Coldplay, which I think a lot of times people that are just regular fans go, man, there's nothing that anybody like Chris Martin is still wondering about the music business. And Chris had his own kind of Counting Crows mythology questions like, I heard Adam was bartending. Did that really happen? So I love that you have stuff like that into this film. So I love that he's in there, and I think he's a very important voice in this film. And in that vein, I wanted to know, like, how did you land on talking to Cyndi Lauper? Because I love seeing Cyndi in this film.
I knew that was coming. Well, I'm raising daughters, so I feel like her music raised me, and
Yeah,
she,
Shiro.
there was a division when you're a kid, and it's like. And this is no shade to Madonna, but you're either a Madonna person or a Cyndi person, and then that will send you in the direction of the rest of your life. Like, I'm a
Sure.
Cyndi person, I'm a weirdo, and I love that. So I felt like she exemplified something that Adam also shared, where she did things her own way, she looked how she wanted to look, she defied a lot of norms. And they were really good friends, but I don't know how, when I was talking to him about sort of the different themes or just sort of perspectives, like, I'd like to explore it from this perspective. I think he was like, you should talk to Cyndi. I'm like, Cyndi Lauper. I was like, oh, okay, yes. So I just wish we could have used more of her in the story, because she has so much experience in the business, she had really interesting
Yeah.
things to say. Would have tipped the balance, and honestly, you would have just been like, "I'm now I'm watching the Cyndi Lauper doc, and she's already got her own doc, so which is great."
Yeah, and that is kind of another interesting thing is just the balance in general, because you've got David Bryson talking about how, as a band, they kind of really had to come to realize that Adam's the one making all the decisions, and we're either okay with that or we're not. And we certainly have seen plenty of bands that have been driven apart because of things like that. Yet at the end of the day, for you, the filmmaker, you're making a film about the Counting Crows. So it's like that had to be a pretty interesting balance to strike, as present as Adam is in this movie, still ultimately making sure that it felt like a film about Counting Crows and not a film about Adam Duritz.
Yeah, definitely. Because I don't think Adam wanted that either. There has, like we talked about at the beginning of this call, you have to have a central kind of reliable narrator. You have to have a hero. It's a hero's journey. And if it were the story of the Kinks or Oasis or something, where it's like it's a two-hander, and we can go back and forth, but that is not the case. However, he has this band of brothers, this marriage of music that they've had for so long, that you absolutely need their perspective, all of them. In fact, we even interviewed the current band members, but it was because of the time frame we were covering, and we had to cut them out, which was heartbreaking because they're really engaging and really funny, and but I felt like, and as you hopefully comes across on screen, like each one of those guys are individually very, like, so intelligent. And I mean, obviously academically intelligent, musically intelligent, but I mean emotional, quote intelligent, like emotionally intelligent, and could speak about their experience navigating the dynamics of the band, and then as a creative artist, and then kind of being along for the ride for some of it. Dan Vickery cracks me up because he's so enthusiastic, and he kind of comes in at this their this peak is taking off, and I just hit where he's like, I was just looking at Adam on stage going, go, and I've felt that in my life when I've seen people or been a part of something, and it's just like you're like, oh my God, let's go, hang on to the rocket ship.
Yeah,
So
it's like a big basketball game where it's like you know that they're gonna win and you're just so excited. That really was that
yeah.
moment. It was nice hearing him illustrate it that way when he was talking about the Saturday Night Live performance, because then
Yeah.
you watch the footage and you're like, oh yeah, that's totally how that feels, which is cool.
Totally. Totally.
For
Yeah.
you, when it comes to doing this film, because I know there's stuff for me that was really pretty bonkers to find out, even being a long time, lifelong fan, whatever. What's some of the stuff that you kind of uncovered that was really fascinating for you as the filmmaker?
It's kind of a blur, to be honest. The whole, this is going to sound like such a generic answer, but I mean, the whole experience is just, you're just constantly uncovering, it's like from Bryson's
Sure.
tour book to the way that Emmy, David Immerglück, the way he tells stories is really, really hilarious to me. I would have a hard time when I, it's rare. I've done so many interviews with celebrities that I know how to keep it together and keep it buttoned up
Of course.
and laugh, but without breaking the take where my audio comes across, And I broke so many of the takes with Emmer because he was just had this way of like had almost like a bad Santa way of laughing and blah blah blah. He was cracking me up. His stories were so funny and so detailed, and I was losing it. So I think at every step of the way, I was like, surprised at what I was surprised that Adam let us into his house to film, that he opened up his home and moved all this art and furniture around for us to post up in New York for, weeks, coming and going. It's testament to Adam and his partner Zoe, the generosity. I didn't count on that. That's not always the case at all. I didn't know to the extent to which he was how bad things had gotten for him, and when he, checked himself into the hospital, I didn't know the
Yeah.
details. That. So, I mean, I didn't know the details until it came out of his mouth while the camera was rolling. So, usually you've done, there's research or there's documentation where you can go, okay, I had to ask Cheryl some hard questions, and we've asked Melissa Etheridge some hard questions, and I just hadn't, I didn't know it was it had gotten that bad. So, now the whole thing is just one big surprise. If you're doing it right and paying attention and listening and engaged, the whole thing should be a surprise.
Yeah, absolutely. And as an interviewer, you're right. You've done a certain amount of research, but those really are the moments when they say something that really can just take the conversation in a whole different direction. I separately, but also related, I know what you're talking about the Sheryl Crow film, because I was talking about that with my wife this morning, who's a fellow music journalist, and just how you did have some hard questions to ask. And I think that sometimes when you see a film like that that's going to come, you go, okay, here's the things that they're not going to talk about in that film, but it's like they're was the discussion of the guys that felt jilted about the whole Tuesday Night Music Club thing and the way that whole thing played out for the record that they played on, and so on. So this is just a side trip to say I really appreciated how you handled that whole thing with the Cheryl film, because I thought it was a very honest film in a way that some folks might not have expected for a Sheryl Crow documentary. But I also think it reflects where she is as a person. Like, she is somebody that, what I was telling my wife was, Cheryl's very real, so I don't anticipate that there's much that she would not have been willing to talk about. And whether it's a Sheryl Crow or an Adam Duritz, that's again a benefit to a project like that and like this, when you have somebody that really is willing to talk about anything and just open themselves up in that way, because it's not easy. And as you know, as a filmmaker, sometimes after you've had that conversation, you might get a text or a call after the fact going, "Hey, we talked about this. Let's leave that out. I thought about that more."
I've
And
gotten those texts over the years.
yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
and I always say,
So
like, we have kind of, my whole crew, we're like, we usually, when it gets so hard like that, we're like, listen, we'll take care of you. Like, if you felt you went too far, I'm not ever gonna force anybody just because I said it on camera to shove it in the film if it didn't feel right. But inevitably, like in the case of Cheryl and Adam, all of these people I've been fortunate enough to spend time with, they are the real deal. And they're smart enough to know that if they sign on to do a film like this, there's going to be hard questions that are coming after we've built trust and stuff. I'm not going to ask that on day one, but
yeah.
we're going to get there in some way eventually. Or if they say, no, I don't want to talk about that, then they usually give me a reason why they don't want to talk about it. So, it's for telling stories about other people's lives. I find it really fascinating. It's my life's work because I just find I want to understand the human condition more, what makes us do good things, bad things, sideways things, just a better understanding of our differences and our commonalities. So, it's just really, really fun. And people, then when you come across someone like Adam or Cheryl, they're just so exceptional. They're not like the rest of us. So I just want to know, like, how did you get here? What makes you tick,
100%. I have just a few more things, and I think part of it relates to what you kind of say at the beginning of the film, just about how these guys have had this adoration, and at the same time, as I mentioned, like the critical knocks that they've taken. It's interesting because as I was getting ready to talk to you, in the grand scheme of things, here in 2025, the August and Everything After and Recovering the Satellites albums, it's always weird to say this about records that have sold millions and millions of copies, but they feel a little bit underrated in the sense that they're not being held up on an ongoing basis as records that are essential. And I think the tide is turning in that regard, but that is perhaps one long-term side effect of the critical knocks that they took for a period of years. How do you feel about that, just as far as where those records sit in the musical fan society at this point? Having done a film, do you think they get their proper due? Certainly,
I
that's what you
stay.
hope to accomplish with this film.
Well, no, actually, I stay out of the proper due business. It's not, I'm not, I don't work for the Hall of Fame. I don't have like my
Sure.
knowledge about, because like I love to read Lester Bangs and I love to read when he's thrilled about Astral Weeks. And I also love to read when he's just ragging on James Taylor. I disagree with him,
Absolutely.
but I find it wildly fascinating. So it's such a music is such a personal and subjective thing. The notion of having got their due is like, according to who? I don't know.
Sure.
Maybe, I think what I did, for example, I did my first film was about the filmmaker Hal Ashby. I wasn't trying to go, he hasn't got his due. It was more like, have you guys connected the dots and looked at this guy's body of work? Because he seemed like he would make a lot of different films and not everyone knew that. No, that's all the same director. Wow. It was more of a holistic approach to appreciating someone's body of work. So like I hope that that happens, but it's, especially the music industry is such a fickle beast. I have no idea what
Yeah.
happened after the film gets shot out into the universe.
Well, that kind of dovetails nicely into a question that I had just later, which was basically like, what do you want people to take away from after they see this film? What do you want them to get out of this film?
Yeah, I just would like them to watch it, because because of like what we discussed about like, oh, that band, I love that band, or oh, that band's not cool or whatever. I challenge you to watch it because I think it will surprise you on both ends. I think fans will be surprised. I think haters will be surprised. I think it's I used to joke with my crew. I was like, is this a, and I'm not like a religious person, but I was like, did I just make the theme of this movie like do unto others? You know, it's like really hung up on, did we just make the golden rule? Because at one point it felt so, it was a little too unbalanced, but heavy-handed in the way of like, why are we treating each other like this? And what is this? What are we doing with people, with celebrity and the notion of celebrity? I kind of backed off on that a little bit because it felt extremely moralistic. So I just want people, I just think that he's a fascinating guy, and their music is worth listening to, and the story is worth watching. So
Yeah, I like that. What's your next project?
I might be all contracted up to not talk about it, but I did just now finish another film about another musician, a female.
Cool.
Totally different, totally on the other side of the, you couldn't be more opposite, and yet
Yeah.
also very cool, very driven, such a wild story with this woman. So that should come out in the spring. And then I have some classic rock projects, but I cannot talk about those yet, but I will remember
Oh,
to
that's
hit you
awesome.
up in the future.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Yep.
Yeah. Is it interesting for you when you're doing films like Hal Ashby, as you said, Melissa, Cheryl? Are there really tangible things that you learn with each one of those films that, for example, ultimately helped you doing this film? There's got to
Oh
be a
yeah.
lot of takeaways in that regard that you're
Oh
just
my
like, okay, here's what I'm not going to do with this next film that happened with this one.
Every single time, absolutely, especially with musicians, because they are not like the rest of us. They're different
Yeah.
individuals. They are very, you know, with creativity comes a lot of sensitivity and introspection, and we hold, it's such a weird thing, music now, because there's so much idolatry, and yet what do they get paid, like per stream, per song is like 0.000. I mean, it's ridiculous. So I think you just, with each film, as far as musicians are concerned, you just have to learn how to, you know when to hold them and know when to fold them with the camera, and like get in and then get out and give them space, and like, you know, be like savvy to the read the room. Always working on reading the room, especially when you have a band and they're together and there's different that dynamic. You're not involved in that dynamic. So,
Yeah.
but yeah, it's interesting. I've learned so much. You know, the fa failing at every time I do something stupid, I'm like, oh my God, oh, I can't believe I did that. And then I'm like, well, no, I will never do that again. So
Yeah.
it's good.
Well, congrats on this film. I'm glad that you called out your team earlier because getting ready for this, I'd read an interview that your guy Matt Thiessen had done. It was fascinating to read how he kind of approached some of the stuff on this film. And I also
He's
know your archivist person, Jackie Clary. I know her through the Rock Hall. So
Yes.
you just knowing those two people, knowing of those two people,
There you go.
you have a great team of folks that you're working with, and you guys have a film you should really be proud of. And I know you guys are, so that's awesome.
Oh, thank you so much, Matt. This has been a really fun conversation.
You and I have talked a good amount over the years, and it made me think of one particular time that we spoke when you were doing the Outlaw Road show tour. We talked about a lot of current bands you were into at the time. As we wrapped, you asked me for my email because you were going to send me music from those bands. So I've always appreciated that at the core, you're a music fan. And something that we haven't talked about, I remember hearing way back that you were, growing up into concert bootlegs like Springsteen probably would be one. So I just wondered what your memories are of that period for you as a music fan. Like, were you trading cassettes with people? Like, what did all that kind of look like at the time?
Well, not so much growing up as like I had some growing up, but they tended to not be as good back when they were doing it on vinyl and the cassettes, you know.
Sure.
But certainly during the period of my career, there were a good 10 or 20 years where bootlegs were really cool. You know, the packaging that came out with some of the companies. I mean, I have a wall of CD bootlegs here, like a whole wall of it. I got a ton of Dylan bootlegs, a ton of Springsteen bootlegs, a ton of Radiohead, really great Radiohead bootlegs, bunch of Roy Harper and Robin Hitchcock, a lot of Joni stuff. Trying to think what else. Got some good Oasis ones, a bunch of great Zeppelin bootlegs. Trying to think what else. Who else had great bootlegs? Neil Young, a lot of really good live Neil Young stuff. I mean, I just got really obsessed with it. Like I had a friend who was a bootlegger who died a few years ago, but he used to show up at our concerts and he would just open up his trunk and he would have all these crates, thousands and thousands of bootlegs, and he would bring it in and it would be like a flea market in our dressing room, you know? And everyone would come by and be like flipping out over it. Or Immer and I would go to his house and go through. He made them himself too, Johnny Legs. He was great. You know, and there were a lot of record stores in New York back then too that sold them. So you could find really cool stuff. There's a lot of great REM stuff. I'm spacing on the rest of it now. But yeah, I really loved that because the thing is, as a music fan, when you love a band, you've probably got the records, you know? So
For
what else
sure.
can you, what else can you collect after that? You know, what else can you explore? You know, they only make records every so often, but they play concerts all the time. Little Feat has a lot of great bootlegs because they were a great live band. The band as well. A lot of really good Elvis Costello ones too. My favorite bootlegs ever probably are the Blue Nile. I had some really good Blue Nile bootlegs. That's also one of my favorite concerts I ever saw. Yeah, because it was such, there was so much more inspiration to be gleaned from the live shows because, you know, once you've got the records, you listen to them over and over and over again. But how much more are they, you know, like you can't get a lot. There's not going to be a million more records because people don't make them that often. So bootlegs were a great way to explore your favorite bands, you know, and, you know, you go to a great concert. But it's only one night, but they might have recorded every night on the tour. You know what I mean? You could get a bunch of that stuff. Yeah. So I really loved that. It was just so rewarding. And there was so much to be enjoyed and appreciated. And it wasn't until years later, too, that like people like Dylan started putting out the bootleg series where you could, you know, get a lot of this unreleased stuff. But before that, you really had to go look for it yourself. I suppose that Biograph collection he put out was really the first one that was a publicly available bootleg that way, you
For
know.
sure. Yeah.
You know, and now like things that we were searched for years are just available. You know, like you would look for people made bootlegs that collected all the songs that would have made up the record Smile, you know, by the Beach Boys. But that's the kind of thing that the record companies at this point have put that out. And the same thing for like Dylan in 66, that tour where he used electric and acoustic, you know. The entirety of that I had on the bootlegs. And then later on you got it you know, from Dylan himself put it out as a box set, which is great. I mean, I love box sets, but before that stuff was available as box sets, you had to go, you know, find it.
Yeah. Oh,
And the
yeah.
bootlegs had it, you know.
Yeah. And that seems like, you know, it must have been pretty instructive for you, you know, with the way you guys kind of structure your set list. And I mean, this has been this way for a long time, but like maybe it gets amplified a little bit, because you guys were, you know, one of the earlier bands to kind of start, you know, putting out official downloads of every show that you play. And so certainly as a fan, like you understood the appeal in that, but you know, understanding that you guys already had kind of a unique approach as a band, like how much did the idea of that like kind of make you kind of start even thinking about the set list more from that point?
Well, I mean, one thing you know, you realize from a lot of those bootlegs is that they may have played the same set every night, a lot of those
Sure.
bands, you know. But they still did it a little differently and it's still really cool, you know. You know, for me, it was just kind of that I've always thought that like that people were making a mistake that were really precious about not allowing people to record at concerts. Because the truth is, those people who are coming to your concert to record, they've bought all your albums. They probably have multiple copies because they have CDs in different cars. You know what I mean? Like, that, you know, those people aren't ripping you off. They're just going to promote the fact that you're great live. And so I always felt like we should let people record at concerts, because all it is a free commercial for how good we are live. And the more that gets out there, the more people want to come to concerts. I never felt like it was going to detract from ticket sales or anything like that. I thought it would promote them. It was like, you know, it's the same thing with the internet. You've got this, in the years before that, everybody was really precious about trying to protect everything that belonged to them. But, and that may have come more from the record companies trying to do that. But the internet is a free way to connect to everyone in the world at the same time, you know? And like, I've kind of felt like everything you could do to get past the gatekeepers was a good idea. Let people record your concerts, put stuff out on the internet for free, whatever, you know, like just,
yeah.
Cause I was, as a music geek, I loved it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have a couple more things I'm going to move into talking specifically about the record. But, you know, you just made me think of something, just, you know, stuff being out there. You know, when you guys were about to put out Recovering the Satellites, you did some shows, I think, leading up to that where you played the entire record. And I can remember, like, you know, not too long, like maybe a week or so after one of those shows had happened, somebody sends me like a DAT tape of, you know, it was just somebody sitting in the audience that like recorded the show. So that was kind of the first way I got to hear Recovering the Satellites. So as technology has progressed, like, it must be pretty interesting for you, because the feedback, as we know now, got a lot more instant after that. So it's got to be interesting for you, like, how fast you can get that feedback in a way that you maybe couldn't necessarily back then.
Well, that year you're talking about, what I really remember from that year when we were making Recovering the Satellites, and in the months before that, was I had just moved to LA, and I remember discovering that AOL had these message boards for the different bands. And so I went on them and I was reading all this stuff, and all these people were really freaked out on the Counting Crows message board. Are they ever going to make a record again? Are they breaking up? Is Adam quitting the band, or what's going on? Everybody had questions, and I realized, oh, I have all the answers. I can answer all their questions. All I have to do is sign in the message board and convince them it's me. And because before that, you had to go through the press and hope your message wasn't diluted, or you had to go through the radio stations. And that was your only way of connecting with your fans, was through these kind of gatekeepers. And I remember sitting there at my computer on a dial-up modem and realizing, oh, I can answer personally all their questions. I can talk to all these people every day this week if I want to, you know, and going on there and writing. And it took me a little while to convince them that it was me. But we started this community on that at that point. This is pre any kind of social media, you know? And I just remember the thought was, wow, this has the possibility of connecting me directly to everyone in the world for free. No advertisements, no payola at radio stations, no begging for favor. It's just, you can just talk to them. And I thought, oh, this internet thing is great. And I really dedicated myself to being on that message board back then. That was, you know, I remember it was in the months that year when we were, before we started recording, and then while we were making Recovering the Satellites, that realization that this thing is going to make everything different, you know? And so when Twitter came along, I jumped on that. Like, I built our thing up into a couple million really early on. I'd missed the boat on Instagram and TikTok. I was behind on that. But, you know, you get older and you just don't recognize as quickly as you did. And also, like, your life becomes consumed by things other than your social media. For a while there, I was really on it.
Yeah. 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 I mean, going back to what you said about those message boards, that had to be pretty wild for you, that like, you guys have like had the incredible run that you had with August and everything after. And there's people going, I wonder if these guys are ever going to do anything again. Like, you know, it's like, it's interesting that the, but you understand it as a fan, like, but it's interesting the questions that people come up with as fans.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've always toured for so long after every record that it was impossible for the next record to come that quickly. And after that first record, I mean, I kind of flipped out, so I needed a break. So even after a year and a half on the road, I probably took 6 months away from the band where I just told the guys, I'm not in a band right now, don't call me. You know, so I really understood why the fans were like that, because it had been 2 years at that point since August.
For the first four records. Time.
Yeah. I mean, for the at first four time. Records, it was about 3 years between records for every record, because we would tour for a year and a half, take a little bit of time off, and then make a record. It takes a little bit to put it out, and it would always be 3 years. A little longer now sometimes, you know.
Yeah. You know, I really enjoyed the initial Butter Miracle Suite 1 EP when it was released in 2021, and it seems like you took a certain path because you had an album in mind, but with the EP, it's almost like we got a look at a slice of it. And knowing how prolific you can be as a writer, like, it seems like it would be an interesting process to arrive at where we are now with a full album. Were these additional songs already around as well? Like, what did the trajectory of this whole thing look like?
No, you know, when I wrote the suite, it was just a challenge to do this kind of musical composition of these songs that flow through each other. There was never any intention to do anything other than that. It was just this, I kind of wanted to try to write this kind of a composition. And I was very excited about doing it. And it was hard. And I was thrilled with how it turned out. And I had no plans to do anything else. But then I started, you know, it's only kind of half a record, so maybe I should. And I went right after that, and I wrote all that on my friend's farm in England. I was spending a lot of time, like, in the woods, you know. And I went back there the next year and did the same thing and wrote all these songs. And on my way home, I stopped in London. Some friends of mine were recording their record, this band Gang of Youths, and I'd already sung on the record once, but they had scrapped the record and started it over. So I went to sing on it again. And then I went home, and when I got home, a little while after I got there, David Leopepe, the singer, sent me the finished record. And when I heard it, I realized, oh, this is great. And I don't think I've hit this bar with these new songs. Like, they're not good enough. They need some work. And so I went back. I didn't throw them out or anything. You know, I thought Virginia Through the Rain was great, period. Spaceman in Tulsa, I really tightened it up. It had too many parts, too many sections. And I tightened it up and fixed the lyrics, got them, really honed them down. With Under the Aurora was a different song. I kept all the verses, but I rewrote the choruses and made what Under the Aurora. Boxcars, wow. On a lot of these songs I had written, it's like I was writing songs that were kind of past my ability to play. I'm not a great piano player or anything. And like, I had the ideas for these songs and I knew how they went, but I couldn't play them on the piano. And I think that contributed to me, even once I'd done some of the rewriting, not being sure how good they were. And I sat with them for 2 years after that. They just sat there because I wasn't confident about them. And I didn't even send them to the band, I don't think. And then what happened was I wrote With Love From A to Z, which is the only one of the songs that was written here at home. And when I wrote that, I went back and looked at the other songs, and I called up Immer, our guitar player, and Millard and Jim, our bass player and drummer, and I said, I need you guys to come to my house. And I need to play these songs with you so I can figure out if they're any good. I feel like they are, but I can't play them and I can't tell. And I hear them as a band, and all I can do is play them on the piano, if at all. And so they came a few weeks later, it's like in January, and we just started demoing them, or February. And each time we do a song, it was like, oh, fuck, that's great. I love that song. I love Spaceman in Tulsa. Aurora was so cool with the rewrites. You know, Virginia Through the Rain was beautiful. And like Boxcars, I hadn't even been able to finish it because it was such a guitar song to me that I couldn't play it well enough to write over it. And so I didn't even finish it until that week when we were in the house. and the guys were playing it, and I was like, fuck, this song's so good. Now I get it. I had the chorus done, kind of. And I finished it right there. And With Love From A to Z was my favorite, and it was just so right. And we were so excited coming out of that week at my house, demoing all that stuff, that we went into the studio to record it like 2 weeks later. And two or three weeks later in March, we did it in like 11 days, maybe 10 days. It was all done. It was really quick. Yeah. And it just, you know, it would have been these records, both the Suite and this, were the quickest recordings we've ever done. The Suite was done in 2 weeks, and the Sweet Tooth, the side A, was 11 days, 12 days, maybe. But there was this huge chunk of time in between the two where I was sitting on the songs for Sweet Tooth, unsure if they were any good. Like, I have never in my life done this thing where I wrote a bunch of songs and then realized they weren't good enough like that. It's never happened to me before in my life. I'm glad I did, because they needed the work and they're great now. But it was really weird, because like, you know, the other thing is, when I was writing them, I was trying to figure out whether they should be a suite as well, whether I wanted to write connecting parts so that it was two different suites. But I just decided I loved them the way they were. And it didn't need to be two sides of all suites. There was no real reason for it except to do it.
Yeah.
With Boxcars, you know, being kind of one of the last songs that you finished, I don't know if you find this, but it does seem like there is some sort of magic with like that last minute song that's like the last one to be finished sometimes with a lot of bands. Like, have you found that traditionally at all, like in your history writing for your band? Like, because it's just
sometimes.
Like you hear. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, there were songs that were written right at the end. I mean, like A Long December was written in the middle of recording that record. What else was that way? Holiday in Spain, for sure. I didn't write it until we were already mixing the record. We recorded that like whimsically that day. I don't remember if there's anything from Desert Light that was that way. But yeah, it happens. I wrote about half of Desert Light and half of Hard Candy in the studio. Boxcars is a funny one to me, because Boxcars I started writing during the pandemic. But I mean, I shouldn't say that. I didn't really. But I had this guitar riff in my head. You know, there was 2 years there where I couldn't play at all because we were locked, you know, we're shut down. And I was running around the house going, na 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 na. It was I shouldn't say it. That's not what I was doing. What I was doing was going, coronavirus, coronavirus, coronavirus. I mean, living in New York during the pandemic was scary, you know? And
yeah,
I had just, you know, you needed ways to like loosen up. And I had this joke. I was running around the house playing this guitar riff that I called coronavirus and singing it around the house. And then I realized, wow, this is such a great guitar riff, you know, but I mean, it's ridiculous as a song. I can't really call it coronavirus and write a song around this. But I love this guitar riff. And then a while later, when I wrote kind of the verse and chorus music to Boxcars, I was thinking, oh man, you know, what would be really great around this is that coronavirus riff. Like the fact that it came back to life, this ridiculous thing that I was running around the house humming to myself like an earworm for 2 years while I was locked here, just me and Zoe by ourselves, driving Zoe crazy because I'm like, coronavirus, coronavirus. The fact that
she's stuck in some bad SNL episode.
Yeah. And the fact that it came back to life as the riff for this song, but I really wasn't sure until the band, that was when I really couldn't tell until the band got here. I'm like, well, I think this works great as the intro riff, as the signature riff for this song. You guys play it. Let me hear it. And it was yeah, fucking magic, you know?
You know, if we look at that initial suite, like it's challenging to write long form the way you did with that suite. And I've been talking to a good number of prog rock folks recently, so it's always interesting to dig into their process. I wondered like that, maybe as I thought about that one word made me wonder, like, how much were you into the prog rock thing growing up, and how much were bands like that instructive when it came to you putting together the four songs that you did, you know, in a sweet type of fashion the way you did with that?
Well, I mean, I listened to everything as a kid. So that includes, you know, The Land Lies Down on Broadway, you know, and other, you know, certainly I listened to the Yes album. But I think this was more informed by the second side of Abbey Road, you know, the huge melody. And what is it? The first side of the Wild Vienna's and the E Street Shuffle. You know, there's a lot of records. All of What's Going On. There's a lot of records where there are music that flows like that. I don't think it was necessarily prog stuff that was influencing me there.
Yeah, it's magical though when you start hearing stuff like that as a music fan. Like,
yeah,
and you're processing almost in real time. You know that. Oh, this is all connected. This is all together.
I mean, I think what happened was I hadn't written anything for a good amount of years, and I was on my friend's farm, and I got this urge to play, and I got a keyboard out there, rented a keyboard, and the first thing I wrote was The Tall Grass, and as I was working on it, I wrote it all one day, and the next day I went back to play it to see if it was really done the next morning, you know, and I was playing it through, and I got to the outro and I started sort of messing around with the chords and playing it a little differently. And I sang this line, Bobby was a kid from around the town. Oh, I was like, oh, I really like that, you know, and I thought, oh, maybe this is like Palisades Park, where it's a longer song than I think it is, and it has several movements to it, and this is another movement to the song. And as I worked on it with that latter part, I realized, no, this isn't the longer part of this song. This is a different song. You know, it became Elevator Boots, obviously. And as I was writing Elevator Boots, I was like, well, this is a totally different song, but isn't it cool the way it just flowed right out of that first song? And then I thought, what if I write a whole series of these where each new song is informed by the one that came before it, you know? And so I then, after I wrote Elevator Boots, I worked my way from the outro that I designed for that into what became Angel of 14th Street, you know? And then that led me right into the big power chords for Bobby and the Rat Kings. And each song seemed to kind of determine where the next song was going to go. But it really began with just that accident playing through the end of The Tall Grass and ending up in what became Elevator Boots, you know? And then I was like, this would be a really cool challenge. What if I made, you know, as a composer, what if I challenged myself here to write a series of songs like this? But it wasn't an idea I had beforehand. It was really just because it happened on its own accidentally. And then I forced myself to.
You mentioned Virginia Through the Rain. That is a beautiful song. Did you have the title first? Because that seems like one of those titles that would have launched a bunch of ideas if it was percolating anywhere in your head.
Yeah, that was kind of the first thing. I was actually on a train traveling down to see my sister, and she lives outside of DC, and it was raining. And I just started thinking of this thing. Can barely see Virginia through the rain. Wouldn't it be interesting? Because there's like the fact that that's a place and a name. I knew a girl named Virginia. And I was like, oh, it'd be interesting to write a song where like it's about both things, kind of, you know? And yeah, so the first thing I had was that line, I can barely see Virginia through the rain, you know? And then I went, home and started working on it, and then I didn't really finish it, I think, until I got to the farm a while later when I was writing everything else. But I had kind of the idea and maybe the music after that weekend, because I hummed some stuff into my phone on the train that day, just kind of some melodies for that part of the song, and then I started working on it again when I got home. But I didn't really write the whole thing until I was on the farm. It's funny that you said that though, because that is exactly what happened. Yeah.
No, I mean, there's some great titles on this record that it's just like, you're just like, oh man, like if that's where you started from, you know, I mean, it's a great place to start. So
that's kind of the same thing with Spaceman in Tulsa. It kind of grew out of that line. I wrote the piece of music that was the verse into the pre-chorus, and I had that line, doesn't anybody want to be a rock and roll queen? Then the next line was actually, dress your bitch up in a diamond tiara. And what it meant was, your inner bitch, that inside, the bitch inside you who wants to wear a tiara, dress your bitch up in a diamond tiara. But, and it was that way all the way into recording it. And I just, a couple people in the band were like, so who's the bitch? And I was like, oh yeah, people are going to misinterpret this. They're going to think I'm talking about just some girl and I'm calling her a bitch. That's not going to work. So I changed it to dress yourself up in a diamond tiara, because it just, everyone who heard it got it wrong.
Yeah.
So
sure.
But that was the first lines I had. I had, doesn't anybody want to be a rock and roll queen? Dress your bitch up in a diamond tiara. That was the genesis of that song.
Well, here's where I'll end. And it's just another bit from your rock and roll past. It's kind of like the posters that come climbing off your walls, as they say. Your band gets tapped to fill in for Van Morrison and perform at his Rock Hall induction 93. You guys were introduced by Robbie Robertson. Like, just the bullet point details there are incredible. Like, what did that actual night feel like? That's so early in the band history.
Well, I mean, I think we're probably the only unknown band to ever play at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I mean, I don't think there's ever been anybody else who did that. What happened was Robbie was the music director and Van wasn't coming. And so, you know, somebody in the board suggested, I think Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers or something. And Robbie said, you know, there's this band that's recording their first record right now in the Hills that I know, and they would be great for this. And
wow.
He called us. We were in the middle of making that record. And we got the call on Sunday night. We were actually home for the weekend. We had gone back up to the Bay Area. The rehearsals were Monday and the show was Tuesday, I think. So like, we got the call. We jumped in the car, stopped at Tower Records. On my dad picked me and Immer and Dave Bryson up. And or me and Immer up, and Dave met us in the airport. We stopped at the Tower Records on the way to the airport and picked up a bunch of Van Morrison records just so we could kind of figure out what song we wanted to play. And we were listening to them when we got down there and chose Caravan, rehearsed it that night. And the like rehearsals were the next afternoon. We had to show up and we walk into the rehearsal space, and there's like, the band was Robbie on guitar, and Don was on bass, Jim Keltner on drums, Ben Montench from the Heartbreakers on keyboards, standing around the room. When we walk up, we hear people playing Roadhouse Blues. It's the Doors with Eddie Vedder singing lead. Leaning against the wall when we walk in that room to the rehearsal space is Clapton and Jack Bruce. Ginger Baker's late, which is right on schedule to me. And they're all just standing around in this room. Springsteen's there and John Fogerty, because John Fogerty's getting inducted. Sly and the Family Stone were getting inducted by George Clinton. Cream was getting inducted. I mean, I'm probably the first guy in my generation to see Cream, because they played that night. You know, it was awesome. Etta James, Ruth Brown, all getting inducted. And so, you know, it was pretty wild. It was a cool crowd to get to hang out with as a guy who's a complete unknown kid. You know, like, I was like, this is really cool.
Last thing related to that is, like, how had you guys connected with Robbie Robertson? Like, how did he know you guys?
R&R guy knew Robbie and took us to meet him before we started making the record. You know, I was really nervous about, we had not been a band for very long when we got signed, a few months.
Yeah.
And I was really nervous about us going into a studio and everybody getting intimidated by being in a big recording studio and trying to play perfectly instead of good, you know, and making this really sterile record. And when we were talking to Robbie, I told him about my concern. And he said, well, why don't you just go make a record in a house? That's what we did. And then it's not as intimidating. It's your studio. It doesn't have anything to do with anybody else. And everyone can relax. And I thought, oh man, that is a great fucking idea. And that's what we did for the first four records. We rented these houses and built our own studios.
Well, Adam, always so fun to talk tunes with you. Congrats on this new record. It's fans are really going to dig this, I think. But thank you for the time. I'll let you run.
Thanks, Thank you.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR Podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.